Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Yes, this is Karen DeGarmo.
Yes, I'm busy on a conference call with a writing class.
Yes, yes. I missed the last 2 weeks, so I'm kind of, yeah.
Oh, you're just, oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought maybe it was somebody coming on. Okay.
No, no.
Okay, you're just like your student. Okay, yeah. I was like, wait a minute, nobody's ever gone hello before, so I don't know what to say. Okay. He comes on like it's 7 o'clock and then has questions and then turns on like a recorder and then we have questions at the end.
Oh, Jesus, I missed 2 weeks. Man, I wonder how I make up that because he hasn't sent it to me.
Did you pull up the thing that he sent you? Could you print out the copy of the 4 seminars?
Yeah, I'm trying to find those. Oh, I've been out of touch here.
He went pretty much by you know, that itinerary.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's two left. Was there any homework?
The first week he gave us homework, and it was to visualize your book with a title and visualize it like in a bookstore. And that was – last week he didn't give us anything. We're supposed to be working on I got to go back home. What was this? Kind of writing a synopsis of your book and
okay.
Title, subtitle on page 8. We did a lot of that. So we're supposed to be working on a lot of that. But he didn't really tell us we had to get it done. We're just supposed to be kind of working on it.
Did you get your book through the mail?
No, it was on my email, and I just printed it.
Yeah, something's gone wrong with my connection here. Yeah, I purchased it, but did it download for you? Is that what you did? You downloaded it?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now. It's probably back in one of my old emails. Sorry, I'll pick up speaker. I think it was just one of those attachments. I just opened it, and then I printed it.
Probably after the first class? Was that it?
No, I did it like about a month before the class when they sent me a confirmation that I was enrolled.
Oh.
And it was, yeah. So if you ask him tonight, he'll probably tell you where to go and you can print it off.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
He'll probably
tell
me where to go. I bet he's.
Well, kind of what he's doing is is pretty much giving you a way to organize your thoughts and constructing your book is pretty much what he's been working on the last couple of weeks.
I hate to interrupt the gossip, but it's great to have you also prompt and interactive. That's excellent. Go ahead and finish your thought.
She's filling me in. I wasn't here for 2 weeks. She's just great.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's all up and posted for you to do an online playback, and you can do fast forward for the discussion if you want to just get to the. But the discussion, I think, is interesting, too. So thoughts and questions about anything that we've talked about or especially that we haven't talked about that might be helpful for getting you in the frame of mind to look at the science of writing, which is exactly what we're going to talk about this seminar. Thoughts, questions?
Hi, it's Paulette.
Paulette, welcome. Go ahead.
Thanks. At the risk of being forced into Book 101 or the remedial class, I really didn't quite get the chunk concept.
The chunk is just, taking one bite at a time to do something that it's kind of the equivalent in writing of running to the next telephone pole. The chunk is just do a chunk. If you have 5 or 10 minutes, if I have 5 or 10 minutes and something occurs to me, I'm going to dictate it. So I've got a chunk. If I come across a story that I really like, I may not exactly have a purpose for it right now, but someday I may, so I'm going to dictate it, and that's a chunk. If I have 30 minutes that I have decided that I'm going to write, I'm going to focus on a specific area and write something about it. Now, I may not use it, but I'm going to write something about it. So that's a chunk. A chunk is just, a small bit of writing that is a small step. It's taking one step at a time. Think about what we do in coaching. We look at now and next, and we help someone focus on the choice architecture of what is the next best action. And then after that, what's the next best action? Because all we ever have to do is the next right thing. Sometimes we may not know exactly what the next right thing is, but we can almost always know what it is. Say you've set aside 30 minutes to sit down and do some writing, and your goal may be, without even thinking about it in these terms, a chunk. Well, you're going to sit there, and you're going to get in state, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute. And if nothing comes to mind, you're still going to sit there because that doesn't give you a free pass to go to the mall. That means that you're going to sit there and think about it and find ways to strategically address getting in state, which is exactly what we're going to talk about, so that you can do a simple next step of writing, which is a chunk. Does that make sense?
Much clearer for me. Thank you very much.
Great,
I appreciate it.
Great. Yeah, I'm glad you said that then. Who else? Any other best practices that any of you would like to share even, or questions or clarifications?
Dave, this is Kip.
Yeah, Kip. Hey, welcome.
Hey, thank you. I found it very helpful to differentiate between writing and editing.
Okay, good, yeah.
I was,
your brain will, too, because it's two totally different parts of your brain, which is why it's good to have it at two different time frames.
Yeah, and I've been asked to write a little bit of a article on a fellow that I knew who just died, and so I usually got stuck, after I got started in the editing part, and then got out of the flow of writing and tried to make the writing sound good or look presentable while I was in the initial stages. And it was just real helpful to give myself permission to write as much as I could and then go back and see what I can do to put it in an order that makes sense and to have it read the way I want to. So that was
really
helpful. You
just said it really well, that you want to get in a state of mind to really let it flow and to create, and that flow of writing, you do not want to stop and move to editing because that's moving from the playing field to the observer's platform. It just doesn't work. It's different parts of the brain. Now, there's a time that editing is going to be very appropriate. Probably 80% of writing is editing, but you don't want to interfere with that creative process when you're doing that to go back and forth, because it will be inefficient and it won't allow that freedom to express yourself in the way that you need to, or to continue or pursue a thought or an idea. So great point, Kip. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, who else? Well, if no one else has anything, I'll go ahead and start, and then I want to save some time at the end. So if anything comes up, or if you want to discuss something further or add something, jot it down, and we'll revisit at the end. We're going to talk about the science of writing that I think is important to know to have an optimum experience when you do write, and as Kip said, when you write to write optimally, and when you edit to be in an optimum state of mind to perform for that function. So that's what I have in mind, and those were both good questions from Paulette and Kip to preface our discussion here. So first, let's talk about your comfort zone. To write and publish your first book, you'll have to leave your comfort zone. A comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process initially, but then once established, resist change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. An increase or decrease in room temperature, even just a degree or two, signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and our brains both contribute to the maintenance of our comfort zone. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it, even when it's uncomfortable or limiting. A comfort zone is simply predictable and becomes automatic. We know how it's going to turn out, and we know the outcome of being in it. A comfort zone can be a repeated role you play in a relationship, or a repeated pattern like procrastination about making needed lifestyle changes. It can take various forms. For example, bargaining with yourself about seriously writing or really completing your book within a specific time frame. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. And remember that a habit is not a definition. It's simply a collection of repetitions. It's a choice that gets repeated. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's an example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they wore headgear with a visual apparatus that exactly reversed everything they saw. Up was down, down was up, so they had to move about so very slowly and carefully because they had to think about every movement that they made and then reverse it. They were in this headgear 24 hours a day. Then they noticed about day 25 something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to do this consciously anymore. Their brains had rewired, developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear 24 hours a day were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. And this, I think, emphasizes consistency and continuity in doing something that's new and different. Your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. For example, if people get more successful, they begin to feel vaguely uncomfortable, different. If you make more money than fits with your self-image, that can cue an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. And here's an example, and I know some of you have heard me mention this before, an example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to the previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of all lottery winners over $3 million file bankruptcy within the first 5 years after they win. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Your mind can reframe. Your brain can rewire. So one possibility here, make a habit of writing. Construct a schedule and be loyal to that schedule. And remember, we talked before, you do not need to be motivated to do this. You only need a plan and to stick to it. Now, let's look at how we frame something, because how you frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change your mind, and your mind can change your brain. Meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or a situation. So the structure of meaning, then, is an inside job. If a traumatized combat veteran hears a car backfires, the stimulus creates an immediate kindling, stimulates an immediate kindling in his amygdala that produces a startle response, which then transports him instantly in a nanosecond to a different place and state of mind. Now, to the companion shoulder to shoulder with him with a very different history, it's a background noise that may not even interrupt conversation or perhaps not even notice. So each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. Here's a simple example. Well, you know, I have too much going on right now to find time to write. I think I'll do it maybe beginning in the fall. Reframed. I have too much going on right now not to create specific scheduled time to write. It's a way I take care of myself. Your response, your perception of an experience and the meaning you attribute to it is the bridge you create between an external event and your internal state. To discern meaning, you have to have a context to surround it. The frame can then determine your state of mind. Our reticular activating system at the base of our brains decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the information streaming into our brains. For example, right now, focus on and pay attention to your feet. Wiggle your toes. Move your feet back and forth in your shoes or sandals, on the carpet or on the floor, and really be aware of what you're experiencing and feeling in your feet. Now, your feet have been there all along. They're one of the millions of bits of data that come in to your reticular activating system to attend to, but we give selective attention to certain things. You specifically specified attention to your feet. Now, here's the moral of that story. You pay attention to whatever fits your life story, the framework you use. Now, let's examine how this reality affects the story of your book. For example, part of your life story is your self-image. If someone says something really nice about you that you don't believe, it's not going to register, or it'll be disavowed with a comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me? Natural filters include belief, self-image, and goals. So, how do you reframe? How do you reprogram your reticular activating system to let in what you want to achieve to write your book? Now, here's the key to this entire discussion on frame. Your book outline is more than your blueprint and plan. It's your frame. When you start writing about something specific, examples of it begin to appear. You begin to see things that suddenly become, you guessed it, a chunk. And then you have an internal organizer to put those chunks together and see them in piles on your desk. Now, it's as if the universe is conspiring to help you achieve your goal. When you start writing about something specific, examples of it begin to appear. I first had a series of experiences in psychoanalysis as a psychoanalyst that I now have in mentor coaching. And I'll bet you recognize it if I can articulate it well. My patients then in analysis who were therapists or psychoanalysts in training would notice that as soon as they worked through an issue and it came to terms with it and resolved it themselves, they noticed suddenly about a half a dozen of their patients would bring that issue up that they had just dealt with. their patients had been unconsciously taking a number, very patiently waiting until it was their turn, and their therapist or their analyst was ready to deal with it. Those of you who are professional coaches no doubt have noticed and will notice the same thing with your clients. They're going to wait for you to get your arms around something so you can help them with it. And suddenly, you're going to begin to see a bunch of people who have something just like you dealt with. Now, as authors, you're going to notice it again, and it will pertain to what you're writing. For example, suddenly, in the first few months after the release of The Secret Language of Money, along with beginning a licensed specialty certified training program for financial coaches and professionals, my clients began giving me so many illustrations. Actually, it happened when I was putting the book together, but it really crystallized even more so. Their money stories then became center stage, needing to be coached. That's what the law of attraction tells us. Whatever you focus on, you'll both notice and bring about. If you're interested in pursuing this a little bit more, there's a white paper on my website, Mentor Path, under the Articles tab called The Neuroscience of the Secret. Now, here's a three-step combination. Let's just say a very simple way to reframe and incorporate your new endeavor. One can simply be visualization. You can create powerful and stimulating internal images. You align the energy field of your brain by your focus, and your focus begins to manifest and seek things that will suddenly appear and you'll be aware of that have been there all along that you weren't aware of before. Those of you who have done training with me, remember when we did the yellow Jeep visualization and a bunch of you saw a yellow Jeep in the next week? The first time I did it with a group of executives who wanted to write a first book, and I asked them if any of them had seen a yellow Jeep, one person out of 24 had in the last month. In the next 3 days, 22 out of 24 contacted me by email or phone saying they had seen a yellow Jeep. Affirmations, the positive validation of doing and being what you want, are the stories that support the visualization. The visualization rewires your brain. The affirmations revise the software of your brain. So to allow yourself to be creative, you have to simply do it. To lose the fear of being wrong, don't focus on the fear. Focus on what you want to do, and the fear will fall away, kind of like your lap when you get up to walk. You can re-engage it by sitting down, but it kind of limits your forward progress. Affirmations will provide a sense of safety as well as of hope. And along with this, you got to have an action plan. Change your behavior to precisely what you want. New behavior, new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, those pathways become more deeply etched. As soon as they're well-grooved, you're going to have a new habit, an automatic behavior that will be the default mode. Your future self lives in your present mind. If you clearly visualize that future self, you can then move ahead to actualize that vision. When you create a visualization, you're creating a future memory. Then you just have to plan ways to strategize into it. So let's look at the science of the vision, especially applied to your book. Recent scans of the brain has confirmed several things about visualization. Visualization brings about actual physical changes in the brain. The brain assimilates a mental picture, whether the stimulus is actual or imagined. In other words, our brains can't tell the difference whether the image is from the optic nerve or whether it's conjured from the prefrontal cortex. The brain can't tell the difference between a mental image and an actual image. Replays of the visualization, such as repeating the vision of successfully attaining your goal of writing your book, programs neural networks and neuronal pathways to more strongly etch the experience. You more strongly etch it when you revisit that visualization in the morning and in the evening. And you know this, and we've known this for some time. PET scans have also established that thoughts bring about physical changes in your brain. So when you program your unconscious, you're actually creating a future memory to live into. And since your brain can't tell it, can't tell who conjured it, your reality, the more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. Now, here's the important aspect. You don't make the brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. This may be why, for example, 95% of people who diet and gain and lose significant weight gain that weight back. They don't reprogram their body image. So, envision the experience of your completed book, not of getting there, but of being there, of announcing its successful release, the entire experience of successful completion. This is a way to incorporate your objective as part of your identity rather than it belonging to somebody else or just being a fantasy. We know that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body responses of fight and flight. Now, while your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can. And your conscious mind has to incorporate this evolving story to assimilate the imagery and your new self-concept as part of your new story. Otherwise, it doesn't register, or it's simply extruded as noise. So there are three key elements. Repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision have to be renewed and repeated regularly, or they'll just fade. They'll be eliminated. Secondly, conscious incorporation of this new vision into an ongoing story has to be ultimately metabolized as part of yourself. Otherwise, you'll lose the vision. And we've talked in training, those of you who've done training with me, we've talked many times about how one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is that we revert to our identity. We may create a change, but then we revert to our identity unless our identity, our core sense of self, is reprogrammed and transformed to incorporate this change as part of an evolving new model. And thirdly, specificity about the experience of having achieved the goal, all the experience, all the feelings, the senses, everything that you're doing and saying. So visualization then crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. So this vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Let me give you one example. Before I move on to a very important topic. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was imprisoned, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had 299s. All his other scores were in triple digits. So to preserve his sanity, he learned to visualize golf. He would get up each day and in his mind get dressed, drive to the golf course, take his warm-ups, smell the flowers, look at the trees, stretch, warm up, take his shots, walk to the next shot. He experienced everything in great detail and spent about 7 hours each day mentally playing the game of golf. When he was released from his captivity, playing golf in his mind 7 days a week for 7 years, his first outing, he shot a 74. The power of a vision of mind over matters. Now, let's talk about states of mind. I believe this is, in my view, the most important concept, the most important success factor of being able to understand and regulate states of mind. So I want to talk about that, especially as it has to do with writing and your book. We enter and exit states of mind fluidly and invisibly, kind of like the precision passage of a baton between relay team members. Each of us has a huge set of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. A state of mind is a psychophysiological state, an internally organized software program. And that software program is unique to each state with its own expectations, attitudes, meanings, feelings. From an infinite sea of stimuli, the unique software package of each state determines what data are relevant, and once those data become input, how the processing occurs. So each mind-body state determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So a key element is our awareness of our different states of mind in order to know what state works best for what purpose. For example, as Kip was reiterating, creative writing and editing, different states of mind. Brainstorming, completing a project, different states of mind. The regulation of feelings and states of mind involves the understanding and mastery of access to each of your different states of mind. I want you to listen to some examples of how artists and authors enter their own creative state for their intended work. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the state of mind she needed to write her macabre literature. Dr. Samuel Johnson and poet W.H. Auden maintain a constant state of stimulation by consistently consuming tea as they wrote. Willa Cather read the Bible to set the right tone prior to her writing. George Sand went immediately from lovemaking to writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. I think those were just kind of good excuses, but that's what they say. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite nonfiction writers, Diane Ackerman, wrote while soaking in a bathtub with a pine plank extended across to get that bubbly, floaty, warm feeling. Coleridge used opium before each stint of writing. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for a sail during an incredible storm so he could then recreate his experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repeatedly during a course of writing to create an emotional framework or to sustain it to house their evolving story. Now, the corresponding state of mind and the reader, often matches with that of the author because the author guides the reader to that state of mind through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. Each of us has a continuum of states with some level of awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and leave different states. We become more or less aware of what's best for a creative endeavor, what's best for conceptual planning. In fact, the optimum state of attention and concentration for each task we undertake, from the alertness required for a business presentation to the state of relaxation that allows us to enter effectively into sleep. So the question then, how do we regulate states of mind? The most important thing I believe we can do to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions leads to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. Now, think about that for just a moment, because that's exactly the way that we work in coaching. What's most important when your client mentions to you that they feel upset or they feel overwhelmed? It's not to go to the strategy of how to deal with what they're doing or how to resolve the first step is to resonate empathically with their state to create a common ground. I hear how overwhelming this has been for you. State always comes first, then strategy and story. The reason state always comes first is our state of mind determines the meaning that we attach to something. And the meaning we attach then determines our behavior. Think about a really simple example. You're having a nice dinner, a great glass of wine with your partner. You hear a little noise. There's a little noise in the backyard. If you happen to hear it, you don't attribute any significance to it, and it doesn't interrupt the flow of your conversation, and you don't even pause your sentence. Now, the next night, you've just seen the most recent episode of Criminal Minds. It's Wednesday night. Don't ask me how I know. You're home alone. That same noise occurs in the backyard, and boom, you're alert. You're wondering what's going on. You're vigilant to be sure that everything is okay. Same stimulus. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach, and the meaning you attach determines your behavior. So this is something that I believe is important to effectively entering a state, for example, of writing or of editing or any other thing that we want to enter efficiently and effectively, like getting to sleep very efficiently, getting to an optimum state of mind to do a keynote. The two primary ways to regulate your state of mind, physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, for example, like a deep breathing, and there are many other ways to do that, meditation, relaxation, visualization, but let's keep it really simple and use deep breathing and a focus, what and how you focus on. So here's an example of doing that, of making it very efficient and very quick. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach Robert Reed arrived, his team ranked 217th in free shot percentage out of 217 teams in his division nationwide. So immediately, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. And a mantra is simply three parts. A cue, which reminds you to do your focus and your physiology. So the cue he suggested, and he suggested each of these, didn't tell his players what to do because he wanted them to kind of craft it on their own. He suggested dribbling twice, the focus be a phrase that would align the energy field of their brains, such as the phrase he gave as an example was relaxed and smooth, and suggested that they take one deep breath in to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. So they did this mantra, the three-part, the cue, the focus, and the physiology. Now, in addition, when they simulated game conditions, so, because he would blow the whistle, and suddenly they went to the free shot line, because in a real game, you don't get to line up and, you know, joke around and shoot 30 free shots and count your best. You're usually on tilt. Somebody fouls you, and you're, you know, upset or hurt. You go to the foul line. You have to suddenly get really regulated. And if they made both of their free shots, they got to take a breather. And if they didn't, they did four laps. So this simulated both away and home condition. It's a controlled study. A basketball team plays the same teams. In the NBA, they play 182 games a year. They lose twice as many games away, most teams, as they do at home. Well, there's a positive energy field at home and a negative energy field away. So there's another component of that. That's not the subject for right now, but what he did then, in 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So think about using a mantra. Think about some cue and a focus and a physiology. Whenever I get ready to receive a call from a client I'm mentor coaching, I spend a minute or two getting very grounded and centered, which is what the mantra does, helps you get grounded and centered, and in the flow of thinking about that client. before I do a keynote. I put my index finger and thumb together on both hands and touch them in the middle to form a little infinity sign. That's because I don't carry a basketball to most keynotes, or I do it under the conference table or in my lap. And have a phrase, relaxed and powerful, and do two deep breaths, in for relaxation, out. And so in about 5, 6, 7 seconds, I am in an optimum state to have total fun and passion and engage that audience to do a keynote. So think about how mantras can calm. They can keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. A mantra, the cue, the focus, and physiology, can get you to exactly the state that you want that would be optimum for that task. You know, so think about when you, if you want, for example, to get to sleep more effectively at night, you do not want to choose a phrase like, you know, relaxed and powerful and I'm ready to go. You want to do something that will focus on calm and relaxation to get to sleep. So be sure your mantra corresponds with the task that you want, and be sure that you use the phrase. If you're auditory, it may be a phrase. If you're visual, it may be a visualization, or it may be something kinesthetic. I worked with a client who wanted to find a way to get completely relaxed and in an optimum state before she made 3 appearances in a row on Oprah. And what she decided to do was to envision herself in a white cone of light that was warm and embracing and relaxing, and got her to an optimum place, both of calm and focus, to be able to engage very successfully in what she did. So let's apply this now to creativity. Inside each of us is a natural, innate energy, a desire to create. When we open ourselves to our creativity, we allow our internal experience to flow through whatever channels are natural: words, pictures, movement. So let's talk about flow now. Flow is a state of mind. To access a creative experience, we need to enter a state of a mind to allow this flow. Flow is a state of heightened focus, productivity, even happiness. The ability to create flow is to be more productive, more satisfied at work, and offers significant advantages. Flow is actually one of the positive states studied a lot in the last couple of decades that contributes so much to effectiveness and performance and is part of a positive psychology. Flow, from another perspective, is the state of mind of being centered and focused without distraction. This state of mind allows full immersion in the process of concentration and performance that can create superior results. In the state of mind of flow, people engage so fully in what they do that they lose track of time. The experience becomes its own reward. It's a way of countering distraction and becoming immersed in purpose. Now, here are some things that can interfere with this creative process, with this flow. So they are obstacles to become aware of in order to avoid. Waiting until it's the right time. Waiting until you think you really have something to say. Waiting until you have enough money to justify the time. Telling yourself it may be too late. Being afraid of what family or friends might think. Thinking that an appointment with yourself for creative time is an indulgence or a luxury. Now, in the beginning, it's not about where you sit, what paper you use, or what you write about. It's about beginning. In the beginning, your job is to begin. A recommendation: consider integrating your writing into other professional activities. We've already discussed how you'll begin to hear vignettes and illustrations to capture. And here's another strategy. Present what you're writing about. While I'm working on a book, I'll only accept speaking engagements that are in the flow of what I'm writing about, so that when I'm working on a presentation, I'm working on a chapter. Now, here's an exercise to consider. morning pages. One way to foster this creativity initially is to do what Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way describes as morning pages. Morning pages are 3 pages of longhand writing done first thing in the morning, totally stream of consciousness. She emphasizes that there is no wrong way to do them. Just write. Even if you can't think of anything to write, write anyhow. Do not edit. Do not judge. Just write. The morning pages are a primary tool for initiating or rediscovering your creativity. Insight changes the brain. This is an application and a result of flow. Both EEG and fMRI monitoring of the brain reveals that at a moment of insight, a complex new set of neural connections is being created. An aha experience, a moment of insight, causes 3 different parts of the brain to light up and makes one move into a more creative state that is more synthetic and integrative and totally creative. Now, contrast this with the effect of receiving information, a directive, facts, an order. Nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. When you solve a problem, neurotransmitters immediately respond with a rewarding release. This is your most powerful way to sustain writing effectively, to facilitate this insight, to create a stimulation that gives you a novel approach. So this is important. Schedule, protect, preserve the space for this creativity to live, to flow. You establish the crucible for this creative force when you set aside time and provide an environment free of intrusions or distractions. Think about the time you set aside and protect that time with the same caution, protection, and dedication that you have to anything else that's really important. Consider unplugging your telephone. Consider not responding to anything else. My time from 6 to 9 in the morning is my creative time. I don't plug in my phone till 9 o'clock in the morning. Nothing is scheduled. No gardener or no pool guy appears. Nobody messes with my time because that's my time. I protect it. I love it. It's my time that is just for me. So let's talk a little bit about some state-specific issues. There's some material in your outline. I'm not going to go into this in much detail, but think about chokes, slumps, and blocks. Thinking too much can cause a choke. That simply means that we move from that state of flow to begin to observe. And it's that state change that creates the content of what follows. A well-rehearsed presentation can go smoothly unless you stop and think about it or slow down and get out of the flow. The same thing can happen if you stop writing to edit. Now, I'm talking nanoseconds. A pro tennis player, I work some with pro athletes and actors. A pro tennis player was off her form right before she was to compete at Wimbledon. We looked at her experience frame by frame, and here's what we saw. The instant she tossed the tennis ball into the air for her first serve, just in a nanosecond, she flashed on her coach, being a little critical of her, telling her to toss it higher. That's all it took to get her out of her flow. An Olympic gymnast, for maybe 2 nanoseconds, would get distracted by a particular competitor and glance over at the competitor. That's all it took to get her out of flow. Now, I give you these examples to think about and be aware of the importance of staying in the flow of writing without stepping outside even for a moment to become an observer or to become a critic of your work or an editor. Reverting to an explicit mode and thinking about it makes it deliberate and considered. That's left brain. and it moves the flow of your creativity, which is the flow from your right brain. Now, slumps are continuing in this explicit mode. It's an extension of a choke. It's analogous to thinking too little. So thinking too much or thinking too little can be equally derailing. So consider the applications to your process of writing, your state of mind, and sustaining that state and doing whatever it takes for that natural flow for your creative process. So what is a writer's block? I've heard a lot of psychoanalysts discuss this, but it's very simple. A block is when the writer can't enter a state of mind to create. Access to the creative state seems blocked. And think about it this way. Anxiety is an energy state. To change to a better state of mind, transform that energy by getting grounded, by becoming present. As just one example, the most effective antidote to stage fright is getting grounded. That means the actor or the presenter has emotional energy that flows into the experience rather than gets blocked or diverted or derailed in some way. So centering brings about mind and body togetherness in full focus. A brief relaxation and centering exercise can be useful. A mantra, three parts, cue, focus, and physiology, to get in state. So here's a summary now of the science of writing, because I want to allow some time for discussion. Since these are some bullet summaries, I think all of these, I believe, are in your outline, because I'm operating from the same outline you are. Since old patterns are hardwired, consistency of focus on new experience is what it takes to change this wiring. So concentrate on new behaviors, possibilities, rather than problems or obstacles, in order to create new brain pathways. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize, the completed book, to lay new mental maps. Regulate states of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning. Left brain plus right brain, intellectual plus emotional. If you're diverted to an old feeling or behavior, immediately redirect energy and ideas to new ideas, to the new story of the process of creative immersion in writing, the discipline and work of rewriting, as another example, to ultimately complete your book. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. Focus aligns and directs energy and efforts. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Remember, from quantum physics and neuroscience, we get what we focus on. So focus on where you want to go, on what you want to do, on what's positive, not on avoiding the negative. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. And finally, think about your new experience and evolving self, how your new experiences will require thinking of yourself in a different way, your new identity as an author, no longer in the old story. I am an author. Here are, I want to conclude with some things that I'm calling inverse wisdom for authors. So these are the highlights of what I've adapted from the introduction to Outsmart Your Brain and instruction manual and adapted for authors. And here's the preface. I came home from college after my freshman year and announced to my mom that I decided to major in psychology. We talked. She was excited for me. Then she mentioned that she'd made an A in her college psychology course. I had no idea she'd even taken it. I said, oh, I didn't know that. You must have really enjoyed it and studied a lot. She said, no, I just answered everything on the test the opposite of what I thought was right. So here's a list of 9 things that are the inverse of conventional wisdom for authors, in honor of my mom, who thought it was all opposite anyway. 1, burn your bridges. make it impossible to go back to an old habit or way of being. If you decide to quit postponing the completion of your book, make it impossible to go back to postponing it. Create an uncomfortable scenario if you should slip back. Focus on the present without the limiting habit. Reward yourself for proceeding and not going back. And even if you have writer's block, you don't get to go to the mall during your writing time. 2, do the opposite of what you normally do when you're afraid, worried, anxious, or uncomfortable or stuck. If you're uncomfortable with public speaking, avoidance will increase the fear, so do more of it. Embrace it. Join Toastmasters. You have to jump in the water because you can't learn to swim on paper. 3, obstacles reveal desires. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. So instead of figuring out a way to sidestep, overcome, outsmart, or go around the obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's not there when you don't create it. Here's the key. When you're ready to recognize that you create an obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. 4, discomfort is a sign of progress. Can be a sign of progress. Moving beyond your comfort zone is necessary for progress. Comfortable is not a place you begin. It's a place you arrive. Moving from a comfort zone is necessary in order to proceed. So you have to tolerate discomfort in the beginning and reframe it as progress, being in new territory, validation that you're moving ahead. 5, lean into the unknown. If you wonder whether you can write and sell a book because you've never done it before, lean into the action of doing it. If you think you're too old to do something, you'll be right. You can tiptoe through life very carefully and arrive safely at death. 6, don't believe every thought you have. I'll never be able to write a book. Thoughts lie a lot. They're like my Uncle Ted, God rest his soul, or I'd have to use another example. You don't have to believe every thought that crosses your mind. You're not even stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. Remember Vincent van Gogh's sage advice? If you hear a voice say, "I'm not a painter," then by all means paint. The voice will be silenced. 7, you do not attract what you want. You create what you focus on. Cue your radar for early recognition. Keep an eye open for yellow jeeps, stories, illustrations for your book, opportunities to talk about what you're writing about. A caveat, talk about your subject, not the book you're writing. Talking about writing your book can dissipate the energy of its writing. How many people do you know who have a book in them or have been working on my book for the last decade? 8, you only see what you believe. I want to say that again. Some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. This fact comes from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. In quantum mechanics, as well as in the brain sciences, the question you ask influences the outcome you see. It directs focus. A well-verified law called the quantum Zeno effect says the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. Consistent focus then rewires the brain. Use the quantum Zeno effect to help you write your book. You'll begin to see more of what you write about. And 9, believe in someone, and he or she will show you why you do. Neuroscience has demonstrated that authentic belief in someone activates that person's brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. I want to say that again because this is amazing to me. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends their usual thinking and performance. That person could be you, the author. That's also why I only work with people in mentor coaching in whom I believe, because I know they'll both teach us why. Okay, we're in discussion mode. We have a few minutes. Your thoughts or questions or clarifications about anything we've talked about or anything you want to add?
Dave, this is Kip.
Please.
I have a question. In the science of vision, you had repetition and consciously incorporate the new vision into a story. What is the difference as in the nuts and bolts of creating a vision from the story?
Well, the vision is the actual event. It's the action scenario of the experience of successfully attaining your goal. What you will say, what you see, who's around you, what you feel, all the experience of it. And the story is incorporating that into the identity that you have of yourself. I am a successful author. So that's incorporated into the story instead of just being the vision that you revisit, say, morning and evening. That makes sense? This is the P in the roadmap. Program new identity to incorporate it and make it yours. So this is the revision of the mind software that corresponds to the rewiring of the brain. And when you make it your story, then that becomes your identity. You've transformed your identity. That's what makes change permanent. That's what makes change permanent in coaching. Because our mind, our brain, our story, all are in synchrony.
Got it.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for clarifying that question and crystallizing it. Other thoughts or questions?
Yes, this is Naomi.
Please, go ahead.
And I have, you kind of blipped out a little bit on that number 9, believe in someone and they will show you why. Can you elaborate more on that?
States of mind and emotion are contagious. From amygdala to amygdala, midbrain to midbrain. That's why confidence, which is a state of mind, is so very important. Because when someone sees that you believe in yourself, when you state a recommendation and a fee for your coaching, they're going to come to believe in you. And that is the primary reason that someone will sign on with you for mentor coaching. A survey was done of several thousand professionals by the Wharton School of Business of all the factors that determined whether somebody signed on or didn't sign on with a professional. Of all the factors, and a very broad net they cast, amount of the fees, state of the economy, credentials, reputation, years of experience, the number one factor far and away was the clarity and the confidence of the professional in making the recommendation. So when we believe in someone, so consider the inverse here, when we believe in someone, that is going to be conveyed, and then they will live into that, and the strategy and the story will follow that state of mind of belief and confidence and engagement and full immersion in the flow. So it becomes a way to actualize or to set the frame for actualizing the story that unfolds. So states of mind, emotions are contagious. The midbrain is involved. Mirror neurons are involved, but it's something that we convey to someone, part of our intuition and part of what's conveyed person to person. Believe it?
I think that is absolutely amazing. Worth the price of the class right there.
Okay. All right. Einstein talked about this when he talked about the unified field theory. His notion, as he put it at the time, was that we are a bundle of energy, and we interact with another person who is also a bundle of energy, and these are mutual and reciprocal. They have an effect. There's an intersubjectivity about that experience. When we interact with a group of people, that collective energy field has an effect on us and us on them. Remember the example I gave? You lose almost twice as many away games when the most of the crowd are sending negative energy. Here's an example that I've done in certain presentations. To get someone from the audience to come up and extend her left arm along parallel to the floor, and I'm behind her, and I ask her to resist pushing down her arm. And I can with some effort, push it down. Now I ask the audience to send her positive energy, really a very positive set of experiences and feelings and energy, and I ask her to resist. I can't push her arm down with one hand. Now, I then ask the audience to send her negative energy, negative thoughts, just for a moment, but ask her then to resist with one finger. I can push down her arm. So these things are contagious.
Thank you for the elaboration.
I think we'll know a lot more in our lifetime, in the not too distant future, about the whole idea of energy and energy fields and how that can have such an important impact on the mind and brain sciences. Well, I know we're over. Thank you all very much. Thank you for your enthusiasm and any communication you've sent. I welcome. Thanks so much. Look forward to picking up with you right here. We'll talk about the business of writing next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.